the field, turns for home.
They're at the top of the stretch.
Top of the stretch.
They're into the stretch.
And here they come into the final furlong.
Final furlong.
Into the final furlong.
They go inside the final furlong.
This is the final furlong on HRRN Live. It's Trainer Talk Wednesday, presented by Bullet Train. Bullet Train, Frankel's three-quarter brother, standing at Wintergreen Stallion Station. Now, here's Mike Pena and Jude Feld.
Well, good afternoon once again, everybody, and welcome to Trainer Talk, presented by Bullet Train here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. We do welcome everybody just joining us around the country on Sirius Channel 93. And for those of you who have been with us for the past 3 hours with our live race coverage on XM 209, welcome back. Trainer Talk Wednesday here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Pena, Baron of the Backstretch, Jude Feld, you know him. He's the pontiff of the Pick Four, and JT, another solid show upcoming. A couple of special guests, Eddie Plisa Jr. going to be here in the first half of the show, and Mike Stidham will be here to tell us his story in the second half.
Yeah, it's a great show considering these guys both have horses on the Derby trail and looking forward to the weekend. Eddie Plisa has his entrant.
It's My Lucky Day.
It's My Lucky Day in Florida, yep. and Mike Stidham has his in Louisiana at the fairground. So it's going to be fun, but we're not interested in how those horses are going to run or anything. We want to hear about these guys in their life.
Yeah, we want to hear their story. And Eddie Plisa, as we mentioned, is up first here on the show. We will not make him wait. The 63-year-old native of Seattle, Washington, he has 2,069 career victories to his credit, earnings of more than $46 million, and nice enough to spend a little time with us here today. Eddie, thanks for taking the time.
My pleasure, guys.
Yeah, welcome to the show. And is it my understanding that you're on your way to the Florida Derby Golf Tournament?
It is. A beautiful day down here in South Florida. And, the festivities are starting here for the Florida Derby. Gulfstream does an outstanding job.
We're not cutting into your range time, are we?
Listen, it doesn't matter. much rather talk to you guys.
Don't want to interrupt you on the putting green or anything beforehand.
That's quite a compliment.
Well, Eddie, we appreciate that. And as I told you on the phone, that this show much more about your life and your background and how you got started in the game as opposed to the horses that you have in training now. But we would be remiss if we didn't spend a couple of minutes talking about It's My Lucky Day. You're on the Derby trail again. He goes in the Florida Derby Saturday. Give us an update on the big horse.
Well, we'll be glad when Saturday evening arrives. He just couldn't be doing any better. He's a very, very happy horse. I think the time between races will probably help him. He's just training great and very anxious to see what happens.
Yeah, you put that mile work into him the other day. I've been crowing about that. I love to see that. That's old school, and I think a lot of these horses have been coming up short in their prep races because they don't train them.
Well, listen, it's something I've been doing for a while, and it seems to work in a lot of instances. So hope it works again.
Yeah, Eddie, his last couple of starts resulting in track record performances, that dominant win in the Holy Bull back on January 26th. You opted to wait until the Florida Derby, bypassing the Fountain of Youth. Explain what went into making that decision.
Well, he's had a pretty full schedule. He hasn't missed much. He ran a number of times at two and certainly the beginning of the three-year-old year. And I just felt if you're going to be on a trail to the Triple Crown, you need to have a fresh horse, and we just figured we'd go ahead and give him a little time off and between races and hopefully accomplish that while he's fresh and ready to roll.
How much does the Triple Crown play into your thoughts? I mean, you're the first trainer in a while that's mentioned that the Triple Crown as opposed to just getting ready for the Derby. You're looking down the road. That's a good sign.
Well, my brother-in-law, John Service, was a participant in the Triple Crown. He had Smarty Jones. It takes a toll on horses. And it is. It's three races. That's why they call it the Triple Crown. Kentucky Derby certainly is at the forefront of that. But, you know, it's changed a lot. Now they have a point system that we never had before, and it's making it more interesting or difficult, depending on how you look at it, what's going to happen. So, you know, just it is what it is. We have no control over that. Churchill Downs has decided to use the point system. So we'll just work with it and do the best we can.
Well, Eddie, this is obviously not the first time you've been down this road to the Kentucky Derby. You did it in 2009 with the Philly three ring. We'll talk more about that as we move throughout the show, I'm sure. But take us back to the beginning. Growing up in Seattle, Washington, you kind of had horse racing in your pedigree. How'd you get started?
Well, I was born in Seattle. I moved to Florida when I was 4 years old. I'm really a product of South Florida. Went to school here my whole life. A Catholic school, kindergarten, the eighth grade, and then high school down here also. But every summer, my father was a jockey at that time, and every summer, wherever he was riding, my mother and I would get in the car the day school got out and drive to wherever he was. And we spent a lot of time in Michigan, spent a lot of time in Ohio, and I always would have a summer job from the time I was six, walking horses at that time for people that he was riding for, and that was how my summers were, my whole growing up period. So, you know, whether it was walking horses until I was old enough to get on horses, and he became a trainer and taught me how to gallop horses, and then rubbed horses, was a groom, assistant trainer, and all that other stuff. It was just my part of my life growing up, and you know, gave me a good foundation for what I'm doing right now.
Did you work for anybody else besides your dad?
Yeah, listen, it's funny. I was talking to Jack Vanberg, who I know who he is, and he knows who I am because my father rode for his father, and I had a conversation with him about 2 weeks ago, and I can remember walking horses for Marion, who's a Hall of Fame trainer in his own right, the father of Jack. So, I mean, that's going back a long, long way. I was only 8 or 9 at the time, but those were the kind of people I was around, and certainly some of it, I think, rubbed off on me. He was an outstanding horseman, and some of the other people that I worked for were outstanding. I did work for my father when he became a trainer. I was his assistant. I would take his second string horses up to Tampa for a number of years. I was going to Rockingham 1 year. It would have been my first year away from South Florida and being on my own. And I needed to go someplace for 30 days before Rockingham opened. And I was second leading trainer at Tampa that year. Pulled into Beulah Park. 30-day meet, and in a 30-day meet, if I had 25 horses, they claimed 21 of them.
Wow.
So it curtailed my trip to Rockingham, never did make it there, came back to South Florida, and was offered a job working in the racing office, which the important part to me at that time was I would get a day off a week. So it was like I get a day off and I get paid, so I went that route for a few years, became assistant racing secretary at Calder Racecourse, assistant racing secretary at Hialeah, and during that time became best friends with Stan Huff. Stan at that time was a leading trainer at Calder, set all kinds of records, and like I said, we were best friends. Went on to New York, picked up Harborview Farm at the time, top outfit in the country, and offered me a job as his assistant, which I took, and went back to work with the horses, missed them, loved being around those kind of horses, loved being in New York, loved being around, you know, that atmosphere. It was something that was totally foreign to me. Again, I grew up on the Bush racetrack, so to speak, Thistle Downs, Detroit, Hazel Park, Tampa Bay Downs, which was Florida Downs at the time, even raced at a place that I'm sure nobody really remembers, a place called Seminole Downs in Orlando. So going from that to the top echelon, not only of racing, but being able to work for Harborview Farm with the kind of horses they had, just gave me a whole different view of the game. And as luck would have it or not, Stan and Harborview severed their relationship, and I was kind of on my own. I kept horses for them for a short period of time because I was training the second string horses at that time at Monmouth Park. And a fellow by the name of Ollie Cohen, who was Crown Stable, who was big in horse racing. He ended up having a horse called Elio, who I'm sure you'll remember, wanted to have horses back in Boston, hired me, who my father had trained for him before, and I went back to Boston for a short period of time. And then ended up in South Florida after that. And Fred Hooper, who I kind of grew up with, my dad trained horses for, offered me a job taking his top horses to New York. Ross Fenstermaker at the time had resigned. Copeland was a three-year-old. Precisionist was a two-year-old. I had the horses on the East Coast. I took over Copeland. That year, Precisionist was the high-weight horse. I had three horses on the experimental highway for Mr. Hooper and did that for a few years with him, and then opened up a public stable. And just things, as horse racing is, you have your ups and downs, you pay your dues. Been very blessed with having great owners over the past. Bernie and B. Oxenberger, people that I trained for 25 plus years, who are no longer with us, trained for them until both of them passed away. I trained for David Mellon, who's partners with It's My Lucky Day now. And again, you know, you put in your dues and it pays off. Sometimes this is a difficult game. Luckily enough, I have horses for Mrs. Weber and Live Oak now, and other people, Rick Shanley, and, you know, just a number of people that are great people to train for. But it's a tough game. It's not anything that I wanted any member of my family involved in.
Well, it's interesting to hear you say that, Eddie, and you mentioned the ups and downs of this sport. We hear that the phrase all the time that this game has the highest highs and the lowest lows, and they can be drastic from day to day. I'll put you on the spot a little bit. The high point of your career to date is what?
Well, I had a horse called Best of the Rest that won $1 million race at Gulfstream. That certainly sticks in my mind. Three ring winning the Acorn was certainly something that was very big for Barry Schwartz. You know, there's been a few instances, nothing in particular. It's just been a few that have been fantastic. And just like you said, it's the highest highs and the lowest lows. And certainly, you know, you experience that in this business.
Yeah, how about that lowest low? What point would you say, hey, I had to pick myself up the mat and keep going a little bit? What would you consider to be maybe the point where you had that lowest low?
Undoubtedly, when three ring flipped over in the paddock at Belmont and died. I mean, she was something special, not only as a performer, not only as a racehorse, but, you know, she had a great personality. My wife and I used to visit her every night, and, you know, it was almost like losing a member of your family. You know, so certainly that was one. And then, you know, again, it's a tough business. One day you've got a lot of horses, next day some owner takes the horses out of there and you're struggling to make a living. So it is what it is. It's not an easy game.
Yeah, it's one of the most difficult things I think you can do. You know, it's an amazing game because no matter how much time you put in, you're not guaranteed anything back. I always used to tell people if you worked at McDonald's as many hours as you trained horses, you could become rich. But if you spent all that time training horses, you might die broke.
Well, listen, there's so many variables in this game. I mean, listen, the bottom line is for a horse trainer, you have to have horses to train. To be successful, you have to have horses with talent. And, you know, basically we all do things, you know, similar, but you have to have the tools to work with. And again, you know, that's the main part of this game that separates everybody from each other. I mean, it's the horses that you have. It's certainly taking care of them, knowing what to do with them. Ownership is a big part of it. You know, some owners don't want to listen to trainers and what we might tell them, this horse needs a break, this horse needs this. And again, you have to feel comfortable in yourself to be able to get that point across to the people, and hopefully you convey it in a positive way where they listen to what you say and they allow you to do your job and do the right thing for the horse.
Trainer Eddie Plesa Jr. joining us here on Trainer Talk, presented by Frankel's three-quarter brother, Bullet Train, standing at Wintergreen Stallion Station in Midway, Kentucky. Eddie, you mentioned that this sport, because it can be so difficult, isn't a sport that you would want any member of your family being involved with. You have three children, Luke, Kyle, and Kelsey. Have they ever come to you and say, hey, Dad, I want to do what you do?
Well, you know, all my children were involved at some age with me. My oldest son, Luke, would have been an outstanding assistant trainer and certainly would have been a big plus for me. He's a police officer. He's a detective down here in South Florida. He's on a gang task force. He's on a rapid response squad in Dade County. He goes to work with a gun every day, and I'm very, very proud of him, and I'm so glad he's doing what he's doing. So for a man to go out there and have a son who's a policeman and feel better about him doing that than being in the business that I'm in, you know, it says a lot about this game. This game has changed dramatically. It's changed drastically. It's not the same game that I grew up in. I don't know what's going to happen in this game 10, 15, 20 years from now. You know, you hope it survives and does well. My son Kyle, you know, works for a logistics company. Both my sons have master's degree. You know, I was lucky. I went to college for one semester, and it was enough to get me through and make me, you know, education wasn't a big thing, but it is for kids nowadays. My daughter, Kelsey, she's in her fourth year of college. She's going to go on to a master's. She was very, very interested in horse racing. It's tough enough on men. It's even tougher on women. You know, she worked for me for a short period of time. She worked for Kelly Breen for two or three summers. And, you know, she's back in school seeking an education, and it doesn't look like she's going to be involved either. You know, this is a great sport. This is a great thing. I mean, there's no question about it. I don't want it to come across that I'm down on horse racing, because I'm not. It's fantastic. But just the economics of the game nowadays, it's not the same that it was, where you can make the kind of living that people can on the outside world.
Yeah, there's so many trainers that are low on horses. There's not as many owners as there used to be. There's not as many people at the racetracks. It's hard to get clients when people aren't coming to the track. They're betting online. They're watching the races on TV from home, and it's hard to generate that interest.
Well, you know, purses are what generates interest as far as I'm concerned. And it's not only the people getting involved owning horses. We have to get the message out to the, especially the young people, to come to the races and find that there is a challenge to it. Handicapping is an art. There is time between races that they seem to have a problem with. But if we could present it to them and get it out the way we do to people that own horses that get bitten by the bug, you know, that's what needs to be done. You know, you have a radio program that teaches and tells people about the business. That's what we need in this business. We got to get people out to the races to bet. We also have to get our fair share of revenue as far as horses are concerned. You know, when you bet, when certain racetracks would rather have you sitting at their racetrack picking up your phone and betting online rather than getting up from your seat, going to a window, because it creates more profit for them, well, then there's something wrong with the business model of what's happening. And, you know, I've heard Satish Sanan, you know, question that, and that's a big question that we need to get taken care of for the security of the sport to continue.
And Eddie, you mentioned the changes in the game, and it certainly has changed. Nobody would ever argue with that. But one track that has undergone its fair share of changes is your home track of Calder. You've had so much success at Calder. You've been leading trainer there multiple times. Why did you decide to make Calder your home base?
Well, I grew up down there. That's where my roots are. That's where my name is more familiar to a lot of people. I do have horses in two places during the course of the year. I have a string of horses up at Monmouth Park in New Jersey, which is very important to me. Calder's always been a base and is the base that brings the horses into the outfit. You know, South Florida's coming across a lot of hard times right now. I mean, we've got Gulfstream that's going to race in the summertime. We've got Calder that's racing in the summertime. And you don't have enough horses to support both places. You would just hope that Churchill Downs and Calder could come up with some kind of solution with Gulfstream and Frank Stronach to be able to coexist and have things go in a positive way. And that's where we're at here in South Florida. South Florida, this is going to be the toughest year for racing in South Florida by far.
Do you think there's some common ground there? You think they can hammer it out?
I don't know. I wish I had an answer. I really don't. It's creating a lot of problems for a lot of people. You know, there's a lot of other things involved. It's just not one racetrack against another. There's people that work at one place and then go to work for the other that are being forced to choose between one or the other, and it's going to leave people out of jobs, and they have families to support, and I think that's the thing that's being missed by everybody. So we'll see what happens.
Eddie, we talked about your highs, your lows, and those points that come along throughout a trainer's career, and it happens to everybody. But one question that we always like to ask trainers here on Trainer Talk is, what horse would you say is the horse that you probably did your best work with that maybe a lot of people don't know about? Maybe it wasn't a stakes horse or a horse that made it to a high level, but a horse that you did some pretty good work with and really a horse that overachieved.
Well, you know, I had mentioned to you a horse earlier, Best of the Rest, who was a stakes winner. You know, probably I would say him, not because he did win a $1 million race, but because of his longevity. He was a horse that had soundness issues. He'd run 3 or 4 times in a year and would have to stop on him and give him time and bring him back. And each year he would come back and he would duplicate or even run better than he had the year before. And we just kept patching him up. And he was where he wanted to be. If you took him to the farm, he missed the racetrack. So, you know, we did the right thing for him. He raced until he was 8 years old. And when he started to diminish in his capacity as far as on the racetrack, we did retire him. He became a stud. Didn't really have an opportunity to show himself. But that was a horse that we really were proud of and did a lot of work. And it wasn't just me. My assistant Frank Perez and other people at the barn, you know, he was what he was. He was an overachiever that if he was on a football team or a basketball team, he was your star. And as long as he went out there, he did the job, and you had to have a lot of respect for him.
Yeah, horses like that are really, really cool, and they don't come along all that often. What was the secret to keeping him together?
You just had to recognize when he needed a break and give it to him and not go for one. Let me run him one more time and see what happens. I hope he'll be okay. You know, you just needed to be honest with yourself and honest with the horse and say, okay, time for your break. We're sending you to the farm. And that was his key and his secret. And needless to say, you know, you had to be careful when you trained him in the morning because of the surface and things like that. So, you know, it's just being aware of him is basically what it was.
Eddie, we've talked about It's My Lucky Day and going down that road to Louisville again. As I mentioned, you've been there with 3 Ring in the past. Talk about how this is different this time, and are there things that you learned on that first journey that are helping you out with this trip here today?
Well, it's different because, first of all, 3 Ring had a ton of talent, but she was running against the boys. It was an opportunity to run in the Derby, and, you know, she probably went off 10 or 12 to 1. If we're lucky enough to run in the Derby, it means we ran a big race in the Florida Derby, and certainly he'll be a horse that will be highly considered. And, you know, this horse I really believe is something out of the ordinary, and we're just waiting to prove that.
Well, Eddie, we want to thank you for being our special guest here today. I know we've been trying to make this interview come together for a few weeks, and we finally got all the stars to align. We're going to let you get to your golf tournament. And by the way, if you see Larry Colmus out there, I don't know if he's playing or not, but if you see him, look out because he cheats. I can tell you that firsthand.
Oh, he's got an eraser and a pencil. Huh?
Hey, what's your handicap, by the way? Do you have one?
Yeah, I'm a 14.
Well, that's pretty good.
That is pretty good. I fired a 95 the other day.
Well, listen, when you come down this way, give me a holler. We'll play, okay?
Absolutely, we'll do. Eddie, thanks so much for being here. All the best on Saturday.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Eddie Plesa Jr., our special guest on the first half of Trainer Talk, presented by Bullet Train. Mike Stidham coming up in the second half. But, what a really nice guy and somebody who has a great story to tell.
Yeah, and I loved all the things he said. I mean, you can tell he's old school. He's been around a while. You know, he knows the game's changing. He wants the best for the game. And a lot of us guys that are in that age group, you know, we always talk about the golden days of racing, but the game has changed a lot. And I wanted to ask him, you know, what he thought about some of the trainers, you know, have so many horses like Pletcher and Baffert and all that. And he's only got a couple that are, you know, on the Derby trail. And I wanted to kind of get that comparison from him, but we'll have to save that for another interview.
We'll catch him down in Florida.
Oh yeah. We'll see him down there.
Yeah. We'll be heading down there, of course, on Wednesday. Well, we are going to be there on Wednesday because we're pre-recording the show on Tuesday because we're going to be at Gulfstream on Wednesday. So we're already there when you're listening to us. How about that? We don't know where the heck we are anymore.
No, and it's going to get worse. Yeah.
We are on the Derby Trail, just like Eddie Plesa and maybe even Mike Stidham.
That's right.
We're going to talk to Mike coming up in the second half of the show. He's on deck looking forward to that visit with Mike Stidham. And this is Trainer Talk, all presented by Bullet Train, Frankel's three-quarter brother, standing at Wintergreen Stallion Station in Midway, Kentucky. It is time to get on board the Bullet Train. We're back with Mike Stidham right after this.
You're listening to Trainer Talk, presented by Bullet Train on HRRN. Bullet Train, it's time to get on board.
Group-winning Bullet Train, the sensational three-quarter brother to the amazing racehorse Frankel, has captured the hearts and dreams of everyone who's seen him. Handsome and correct, he was precocious enough to win his debut at two with a massive 113 time form rating. Bullet Train had the speed American breeders seek and the class to defeat 11 horses who won or placed in a group one. And his pedigree, well, being bred by Judmont Farm, says it all. This year, Bullet Train joins Montjoux and Galileo as top sons of Sadler's Wells at stud. He stands at Wintergreen Stallion Station in Midway, Kentucky, for a $7,500 stud fee. For more information, call Sean Feld at 859-519-9665. Bullet Train has arrived at the station. It's time to get on board.
RacehorseReport.com.
What is it, baby?
International racing, weekend stakes recaps, always free selections, great stories, workout information, racing news, handicapping tips, spot plays, and more.
It's as marvelous and as simple as that.
Join thousands of other thoroughbred racing fans by going to RacehorseReport.com. Make RacehorseReport.com your number one source for thoroughbred racing information.
That's great.
RacehorseReport.com.
This is Daily Racing Form's Dan Illman with some big news about DRF bets. Thousands of players like you have already made the switch to DRF bets, and now there's an even bigger reason for you to join. Free DRF PPs. That's right. For the first time ever, get free Daily Racing Form PPs when you wager with DRF bets. These are the DRF past performances you know and love, and DRF bets is the only place you can get them free. So why wager anywhere else? With DRF bets, you'll get the best sign-up bonus in the business, plus free wagering guides and analysis from DRF's top handicappers, one-click multi-ticket wagering with DRF Ticketmaker, trusted Daily Racing Form customer support, and now free Daily Racing Form PPs. Only one place gives you the PPs you prefer when you wager, DRF bets. Join today and wager with with the most trusted name in racing. And if you sign up right now, you'll get a $125 cash bonus. Find out more at drf.com/bets. That's drf.com/bets.
Tune in to HRRN Saturday for live racing from around the country and around the world. Join Mike Pena and Jude Feld beginning at 12:30 as they bring you live coverage of the Dubai World Cup and the UAE Derby from Gulfstream Park. Then, tune in again beginning at 4 p.m. Eastern for live coverage of the Florida Derby and the Louisiana Derby, as well as a full card of graded stakes races from Gulfstream Park and Fairgrounds. Saturday on the Horse Racing Radio Network. This is HRRN, your exclusive home for Kentucky Derby 139.
And welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Bullet Train here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Pena, Baron of the Backstretch. Jude Feld, he's the pontiff of the Pick Four, and a great visit in the first half of the show with trainer Eddie Plesa Jr., and now we are excited to bring in trainer Mike Stidham for the second half. And Jude, I know you go back a long way with Mike.
Well, not that long.
Well, you know him pretty well.
I do know him well.
But
he's
Mike,
a good fella.
How far does Jude go back with you?
Well, I got out to California in the early 80s, and I'm pretty sure Jude was either already there, and I don't know when he actually started training, but I met Jude through the sometime during the 80s.
Yeah, I started training in 1980, and of course your dad was training out there, and then you showed up, and so it was it's been a while. I don't like to admit to it, you know. Especially you look so young. Yeah, I mean, I got the gray hair and stuff, but you still look like you're in your 30s. So, I know you don't want to be exposed.
Yeah, well, I've got the no hair.
Oh, Mike, look, you've had so much success throughout your career. You grew up in Neptune, New Jersey. At least that's where you were born. You've trained more than 1,300 winners. I think the total's at 1,369, according to Equibase. So you've had your fair share of highs in this game. Take us back to the beginning and getting involved in the sport. How'd you become hooked on horse racing?
Well, the biggest thing for me and the biggest education was really just kind of being just growing up around the racetrack. My father was a jockey when I was born, and you know, we kind of moved around a little bit like a kid in the military, but on the racetrack. And you know, from there, you know, my dad was very closely associated with Bill Hartack, so you know, just being around my father as being a jockey, Hartack being, you know, one of the top riders of all time, you know, gave me my first education about, you know, just being around the racetrack and horses and all that. And I loved it. My dad said to me, hey, you can be on the racetrack, but you're not going to be a trainer or a jockey. You got to go to school and get an education and be a veterinarian. Well, that lasted about all of college, about a year and a half, and I was like, get me back to the track, you know. So it was back to the track, assistant for my dad for a couple of years, and then from there got my career started in like end of 78 in Florida, where I grew up in Miami, and then straight out to California. And you know, as far as the education of learning how to train horses and everything, I got a lot of that from my dad. But as Jude could tell you, you know, coming up through the 80s in California was like, if you couldn't learn anything by watching Charlie Whittingham, Laz Barrera, Bobby Frankel, you know, just on and on, Mandela, all those guys, Gary Jones, if you couldn't learn from watching those guys, you'll never learn anything. So that was as good as it gets.
Yeah, we were very fortunate to. I always say it's, you know, the golden age of racing was waning, but those guys that trained like in the, you know, 60s, 70s, and 80s were all world, in my opinion. And I don't think, you know, other than the ones that are still alive, the Mandelas and the McAnally's, those guys were the cream of the crop, some of the greatest trainers in the country. And you're right. I mean, it was great to be able to pick their brain if you had a question, and all very good, helpful men. If you know, they never put you down if you asked a question of them. They always tried to help you.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, like Dick Mandela has probably been one of the greatest assets to my career, not only as I was coming up, but along the way. You know, he's referred clients to me, and he's been just an unbelievable help and teacher to me about the game and, you know, training horses. And, you know, guys like that are a dying breed because, you know, it's a different world out there in racing today. In my opinion, it's not the same. There's not as many true horsemen out there as there used to be.
Mike, what are some of those things that Dick Mandela has taught you that you still incorporated today into your philosophy in training horses?
Just the Mandela is just an absolute, he's just a creature of complete detail. I mean, he misses nothing. If you've ever, you know, been around Mandela's barn, just everything is, you know, immaculate, everything. He just watches every little detail. He'll pick up little things about horses that the average guy is not even going to see. And, you know, a lot of that comes from just the experience of just being there day in, day out, learning through your mistakes. And again, I think it's more of a big business today than it is actually the horsemen that are watching every little fine detail of the horse and learning, you know, how to train each horse individually. And I think that's what Mandela does so well. Every horse is an individual, and they got an individual training program. So that's probably the biggest thing.
Well, you've certainly had a lot of good customers over the years, and you've done a lot of traveling. Talk about that and what a difficult life it is when you're running horses at several different racetracks.
Okay, well, I can tell you that two marriages, three children that live in different parts of the country is part of the fallout from that. But you know, it's a tough world because basically you have to, in the end of the day, you have to do whatever you can do to keep your, you know, business surviving. You know, I was in Southern California throughout the 80s. Things went good for quite a while, and then they kind of tailed off to the end of the 80s. And I basically was at a point, I was down to like six horses and was about out of the business, and I had to reinvent myself. So the only thing I could do was I went to Northern California and started up there to try to just get myself going again. And I had guys like John Sadler, Mandela, and, you know, other guys like that helped me out, kind of sent me their second stringers up in Northern California, and that kind of jump-started me, got me going again. And then I got the opportunity to go to the Midwest, and that was when I went to New Orleans, Kentucky, you know, Arlington, and then that really kicked things off, and that's where my career really picked up, because it just seems like in the Midwest, where you have the Kentucky breeders, there's just a bigger volume of horses, a bigger volume of owners to you know, choose from and or to choose you. And you know, that's where my career really got going when I moved to the Midwest. And things have, you know, just kind of escalated and snowballed from there. The better you do, the more horses you get, and it's just a big snowball that's gone the right way.
Yeah, Mike Jude wrote a piece for Keeneland that won an Eclipse Award a few years back, and it was called "If It Was Easy, Everyone Would Do It," and it was about training horses. And, you know, you mentioned the two marriages and the children, and a lot of people don't realize you really have to be married to this occupation. It's a 365-day-a-week job. Talk about that commitment.
It's unbelievable. I mean, you know, a lot of people look at horse trainers and think like all they do is stand on the rail and drink coffee. But I wish that was all that was involved.
Yeah, my ex-wife thought that too.
From the outside, it looks like, hey, these guys don't do anything. You know, everybody at the barn is working their butt off, and the trainer just stands there and does nothing. But it's actually, you know, the axe falls on the trainer's head, and not only from a standpoint of making things happen and you know, winning races and producing for the owners, but, you know, to the standpoint of their career as far as medication goes, everything falls on the trainer's head. And that's the bottom line. I mean, the trainer is responsible for everything. And, you know, it's all consuming. You know, yeah, we get away and we get to, you know, travel and get away every once in a while for a little vacation. But the bottom line is you're gone for a while. The phone never stops ringing. Now, in today's world with cell phones, you know, it's on my hip, you know, basically 18 hours a day, and it never stops ringing. And no matter where I'm at, I'm answering calls and responsible for, you know, what's going on at the barn and what's going on with the horses. So it's tougher than it looks. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, and it's definitely a lifestyle. I mean, it's not something that you can just, you know, jump ship and get away for a while. It's a lifestyle. The other thing that you know, has impressed me about guys in the Midwest is they have to have two or three houses. They got two or three cars. They've got, you know, sets of tack for every operation. I mean, it's a far flung empire that you're running.
Yeah, I mean, I'm usually always spread to two divisions, and then it's sometimes like coming up when we leave New Orleans, I'll have three divisions set up for a while until we're finally situated for the summer at Arlington and Churchill. That's where I'll be this summer. So, yeah, it's you know, I've got a home in New Orleans, I've got a condo near Arlington. In Chicago, and then halfway between, I stop off at Keeneland, so we've got a client there that we stay at his farm for the months of April and October. So, yeah, it's just constant, never ending.
Trainer Mike Stidham, our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Bullet Train, Frankel's three-quarter brother, standing at Wintergreen Stallion Station in Midway, Kentucky. Mike, Eddie Plesa was on in the first half of the show with us, and he mentioned that if his children had come to him and asked him about being involved in the game, he'd probably advise them not to do it because of the hardships and the difficulties of this occupation, and it's not for everybody. If your children came to you and asked you that same question, what advice would you give to them?
I would probably say the same thing that my father said to me, which was, hey, get yourself, you know, a proper education. Go, you know, spend your at least four years in college, and have that as a backbone. And then from there, if you want to be involved in the racetrack, at least you got something to fall back on. You got the right education, and that's, you know, that's really important, especially in today's world, because it, like I said in the beginning, it's a whole different world out there as far as a trainer. Just being a good horseman today does not guarantee that you're going to make it as a trainer. It's so much about selling yourself, marketing your product for clients to actually give you an opportunity with horses. So, you know, it's a tough world. And you, for my kids, I've got three daughters, and none of them are involved in the racetrack. I actually bought them a horse this year, and gave them each a third interest just so they would have some involvement in it. But other than that, you know, they're, two of them are grown and one's still in school. But they enjoy it just to a certain extent. Like, hey, Dad, are you running in the Kentucky Derby this year? Oh, if you are, we'd love to go. That's their involvement.
Are they letting you train that horse that you bought for them?
Actually, yeah, they've kept me on as a trainer.
That's good.
I make my bookkeeper send them a monthly bill, even though they don't have to pay anything. I want them to see if they were a horse owner, what it would be costing them to own this horse, so they get a monthly bill.
That's a good education. My son,
teaching a little something.
Yeah, I had a horse for my son, and the horse ran third, and he told me if the horse doesn't win next time, I'm going to give it to Bill Shoemaker. I sold it before I got the runner again.
Trainers are very disposable.
That's right.
Even as a parent.
Mike, I'm curious to know, you mentioned the time when you were down to about six horses and things weren't going all that well, and then you got a chance to rebound from that. And that was obviously one of the lower points in the Mike Stidham career, but what would you consider to be the highlight of your career at this point?
You know, obviously winning, I've won a couple of grade one stakes. Those are the high points, but just achieving a level to where I feel like that I've kind of made it in the business is the highest point for me, meaning, you know, I've got a well-respected stable that you're in, well, for the last probably 8 to 10 years. I've been, you know, in the top 25 in earnings in the country and, you know, that type of just feeling that I've kind of made a little bit of a mark in the business as, you know, a well-respected trainer and racing operation. That to me is the biggest achievement.
Who are some of the horses?
It's been a long battle. Let's put it that way.
Well, it has been a long battle. You've come a long way since that first winter in 1979, I guess, right?
Yeah, 79.
Who was the horse?
That horse was a filly named Pair of Threes that won at Gulfstream Park, and the rider was Donald Macbeth.
Wow.
So, and he's, you know, Don, they had the Don Macbeth charity for a long time, and he was one of the good riders back in the 70s, so.
Speaking of riders, go back to the beginning for a minute. You talked about your dad and the Bill Hartack relationship. Bill, as you mentioned, one of the greatest to ever sit in the saddle. How cool is that as a kid, being able to hang out with Bill Hartack?
It was unbelievable. He was my idol. Everything about him was, you know, just so great to me. I'll never forget one of the big points of my life as a kid growing up. I was 12 years old, and Bartak was riding Majestic Prince in the Derby, 1969. And he won the race. We were there. My father was there. And my dad was actually his business manager and part-time agent. And I got to go into the jocks room after the race, and there must have been 50 reporters all around him in the jocks room asking him questions, and he called me in. I'm 12 years old. He called me in the middle of this big circle of reporters, and I had a tie, a solid color light tie on, and he made me lean down and he signed my tie to my pal Mike, Majestic Prince, and Bill Hartack, and I still have that tie, and that was like, oh my God, I couldn't believe that.
Wow. So,
that's really cool.
But Bill was, you know, he was just a lot of the way Bill was, which was win, you got to win, nothing else, you know, mattered to him. Bill would come home from the races, and we spent a lot of time with him, and he would come home, and he'd come over to dinner, and I would be like, Dad, why is Bill so, you know, unhappy? And he said, oh, He rode five today, and he only won four of them. You know, that was hard. Yeah. I mean, and that's what made him as good as he was. He was such a fierce competitor. And that was instilled in me. And to this day, you know, I go down after a race, and you know, if I didn't win that race, I'm happy if a horse runs good, but winning is so important to me. And I think that, you know, that being inside of you is important in the game, because it just makes you try harder and harder every time. But it was great growing up around Bill. Amazing.
And, you know, as tough as he was, your dad was as nice and pleasant. And, I mean, he was one of the nicest guys I ever met. I mean, I just really loved your dad and loved hanging around him. And he always had a smile on his face. So rare at the racetrack that, you know, you're there at 4:30 in the morning and somebody's smiling at you. And your dad was that kind of a guy.
Yeah. My dad was really a good person. And you know, just an all-around racetrack person. He, you know, from when he was a kid, you know, he started riding at a real early age as a teenager and loved the racetrack, loved everything about it, loved the action of the gambling and the riding and just every aspect of it. He loved it. And that's what kind of got inside of me, being around Bill and my dad was one, you know, as good an education as you could ever get. Just about the game itself.
Yeah, and a nice balance between the really driven guy and the guy that had the right personality to attract clients and stuff. I mean, even people that loved to ride Bill Hartack, some of them didn't like him very much, but everybody liked your dad, so it was a really nice mix.
Exactly. My dad taught me, probably the biggest thing my dad taught me was the public relations, the PR involved in the business, where how to deal with people and, you know, try to, you know, get people to like you, give you an opportunity. And my dad was a good salesman. And so he taught me that end of it. And it's been one of the biggest things to keep me going in the game. Because every day you see guys that are really, really good horsemen that belong in the business that just, tomorrow they're gone because they just don't get the opportunity. Doesn't mean they're not good horsemen. Doesn't mean they're not good trainers, but they're just not getting the opportunity. And you can be as good as Mandela or Whittingham or any of those guys. And if you're not getting horses that have ability, it's going to make you look bad.
Trainer Mike Stidham joining us on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike, I think it would be unfair to ask you the favorite horse that has ever come through your barn, but what are some of the horses that you're always going to remember that will always hold that special place in your heart?
Well, definitely the horse that probably means the most overall would have to be a horse called Manzotti. And that was a horse that I went to France, to Chanty. I picked him out. He was one of a number of horses that I went over there to look at for sale for Harold Goodman, my first client that got me started in the business. And basically his idea was Texas was about to get racing at the time. This was in the 80s. And he knew that they were going to get racing, and his objective was send me over to Europe, find a horse that was well-bred, bring him back, try to win stakes with this horse, and with his pedigree and some black type, make him into a stallion that could stand in Texas. So I had basically one shot at it. I went over there, picked out this horse, Manzotti, by Nijinsky out of a Tom Rolfe mare named Choufleur, and it all worked. He won. We traveled him around, and he won several stakes. He won the Canterbury Cup. He won the John B. Campbell at Pimlico and set a track record, and the whole thing worked. And that turned into him being a stallion. His first crop, Mr. Goodman bred only select mares to him. And out of that first crop came Two Altozano, who was my first grade one winner. So that's, you know, it doesn't get any better than that. You know, you pick out the horse, he becomes a stallion, he produces a grade one winner, and you train that both of them. I mean, that's like as good as it gets.
I think they call that a home run.
That was a big achievement.
That's a good story. Well, we're not really supposed to talk about the horses you've got in your care, but the Louisiana Derby's coming up, and I know all of our listeners are going to want to know the inside scoop on Ground Transport. So why don't you share a little bit about him?
Well, I'll tell you, he's a horse that my assistant, Hillary Pridham, and Marette Farrell and I picked out at the Keeneland, two-year-old in training sale last year. He was a buyback at 75. We bought him for 70,000 after the sale. And he was by Big Brown. I'm a big Broad Brush fan from way back, and he was out of broodmare by Broad Brush. And we liked him on the racetrack. He had a shin that was bothering him at the time. That's why he was a buyback. And we bought him and took our time with him and you know, got him started at the fairgrounds this winter. And second in his first start, ran a good race sprinting. And obviously a two-turn horse, second time out, won impressively in his maiden race, and then came back and won the AL then. And he just continues to keep moving forward on numbers. And his work since his last race have been one better than the next. And, you know, I think he's got the pedigree to be as good as we think he is. And I think he's going to be tough in the Louisiana Derby and hopefully continue on from there. Very nice horse.
Well, Mike, we can't thank you enough for being here with us this afternoon. It's been a lot of fun to visit with you and hear your story, and we wish you all the best there in the Louisiana Derby this weekend. Of course, listeners can tune into that race on Sirius 93. We'll have that exclusive coverage for you here on the Horse Racing Radio Network and on our website at horseracingradio.net. Before we let you go, we always like to give our listeners maybe just a little more insight into trainers and what they do when they're not at the racetrack. What's Mike Stidham's favorite hobby when you're not around the barn?
You know, I really enjoy, I run. I like to run, you know, I don't know, 4 to 5 miles a day. And I get out there with my music on in my ears and run around City Park in New Orleans and put the cell phone down for that hour and really get into that. So I'm kind of into the little bit of a fitness thing, and I really enjoy my time when I'm running and you know, getting some exercise. So that's my relaxation.
That's funny you say that, because Steve Hobby joined us on the show last week, and he actually did the interview from the gym. He had just gotten off the treadmill, and he said that's his hobby. He likes to run and get out and exercise. You want me to see if we can get a match race set up between you two? 5K?
Steve might be a little fitter than me, but anyway, it's a way of unwinding and kind of de-stressing, because it's a stressful business. And that's one of the things that I enjoy the most. And spending time with my daughters, which I'm doing right now. I'm in California and getting ready to get on a plane back to New Orleans.
All right, Mike, we'll let you go do that. Again, thank you so much for being here. All the best on Saturday, and safe travels back to New Orleans.
Okay, and listen, thank you guys for having me on. I really appreciate it.
All right, good luck Saturday.
Okay, dude, take it easy.
Thanks, Mike. Trainer Mike Stidham here on Trainer Talk, presented by Bullet Train. Boy, what a fun show, huh?
Yeah, it was a great show.
Eddie Plesa Jr. in the first half, Mike Stidham in the second half. And the story he told, talking about Mike Stidham, about growing up around Bill Hartack and being at the Derby, Majestic Prince winning, and then having him sign his tie and the way he did it.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, it gives you chills when you hear those kind of stories.
Yeah, that's really cool. I mean, that's a lifetime memory right there. You know, one of the all-time greats of our game, really, Bill Hartack.
If you have missed any portion of this show, a podcast will be available in just a little bit on our website. That's horseracingradio.net. You can go listen at your leisure. And, of course, you can go back and listen to all of our Trainer Talk shows. You can also do that on iTunes, Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes, and check it all out, as we are your home for Kentucky Derby 139 and your home for this weekend's Dubai World Cup, Florida Derby, and Louisiana Derby. You can see that entire broadcast schedule on our website as well.
Yeah, I did a little quick math, and he was 12 years old when Majestic Prince was in the Kentucky Derby, right? So we're the same age. He looks like he's 30. I got to start running or something. Wow.
You don't want to know how old I was, right?
I don't even care.
That's my partner. All right. Well, don't forget, we are back here on Thursday afternoon, 3 to 7 Eastern time. Our Brisnet.com listener call-in show coming up as this show, the Final Furlong Show, from 6 to 7 Eastern time tomorrow. And on Friday, you can join us for our coverage from 3 to 7, our live racing from around the country from 3 to 6. And then from 6 to 7, it's our Express Bet Weekend Stakes preview. So all kinds of things to look forward to coming up throughout the week on the Horse Racing Radio Network as we get you ready for a gigantic weekend at Gulfstream Park and at the fairgrounds. It is the beginning of the 100-point events in the championship series for the Kentucky Derby.
And we got Dubai, too, so it's going to be a busy weekend, but I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, three of those graded stakes from Dubai live with us, 12:30 to 2:30 Saturday afternoon. We'll have the UAE Derby on tape delay, and we will also bring you that coverage of Florida Derby and Louisiana Derby, 4 to 7 Eastern time Saturday afternoon.
And we'll have picks posted on my website, racehorsereport.com, and the HRRN website, so check that out, too.
All right, that'll about do it for us here tonight on Trainer Talk. We hope you enjoyed the show. Eddie Plesa Jr., our thanks to him for joining us in the first half of the show, and Mike Stidham for being here in the second half as well. For our producer, Lee Della Pina, the pontiff of the Pick 4, JT, I'm Mike Pena. We will talk to you tomorrow on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Good night, Barbados.